Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Attorney Michael Ratner with the Center for Constitutional Rights, who discusses the U.S. policy of rendition, which sends American-held prisoners abroad to nations that employ torture as a method of interrogation. Chris Dussault, a member of a Catholic worker peace team that recently spent 2 weeks in Sudan's war-torn province of Darfur, who reports on efforts to reach a nonviolent resolution to the conflict there. And Steve Rendell of the Media Watch Group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, who examines the Bush administration's scandals involving its payment to journalists and credentialing a GOP activist as a White House reporter. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In the aftermath of the Indian Ocean tsunami, the Bush administration is seeking to improve its ties with the Indonesian military, which in recent years has failed to bring human rights abusers to justice. According to the website oneworld.net, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is expected in the near future to certify that the Indonesian army, known as TNI, is fully cooperating in the investigation of the 2002 murder of two American school teachers in the disputed region of West Papua. The certification will allow the TNI to qualify for $600,000 in funds from the International Military Education and Training Program, funds that were suspended in 1992. John Miller of the East Timor Action Network says that Indonesian generals will see U.S. certification as an endorsement of business as usual, which means nothing less than brutal human rights violations and impunity for crimes against humanity. U.S.-based human rights workers point out that Indonesian officials have not fully cooperated with the FBI investigation into the murder of the two teachers outside the Freeport, McMoRan copper and gold mine nearly 3 years ago. The FBI investigation has a suspect for the murders, Antonius Womang, who had business ties with COPASIS, the TNI Special Forces unit that has been tied to human rights abuses in West Papua and East Timor. In a 2004 television interview with the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, Womang admitted he got the ammunition for the attack from the army, but he remains at large and has never been arrested in Indonesia. In the resettlement camp known as New Shade, on the edge of Botswana's central Kalahari Game Reserve, the residents wait in line for food aid. In 2002, the camp's residents, survivors of the central Kalahari, were expelled by Botswana's government in a move touted as bringing the tribe into the modern age. Critics, including Survival International, say the eviction of the Bushmen, which started in the mid-1990s, is only a maneuver to make a grab for the diamonds that lie under the game reserve. According to Mother Jones magazine, the Bushmen's last hope may be a lawsuit before Botswana's High Court to win the right to return to their native land. Once protected from disease by their relative isolation, the Bushmen are now stuck in camps where they cannot grow traditional edible plants and are exposed to a myriad of diseases like AIDS, alcoholism and despair. The game reserve was set aside by the British in 1961 to help preserve the Bushmen's traditional way of life after years of harassment by white farmers and Botswana's ethnic majority, Swana people. For 25 years, the game reserve provided protection, but an expanded diamond trade with the government's blessing moved in on the Bushmen. In the capital city of Gabon, signs for the state-run diamond company, Debswana, a joint venture with De Beers, dominate the skyline. The venture has made Botswana the top producer of diamonds by value in the world, and diamond exports account for 60% of all government revenue. In the days following the eviction of the Bushmen, land in the game reserve and border areas was leased to BHP Billiton, the world's largest mining company, backed by a $2 billion loan from the World Bank. The Village Voice reports that young adults, perhaps the group with the largest stake in the scheme to privatize Social Security, are being ignored by the defenders of the current retirement system. Progressive groups are reported to be shunning young adults largely because of the belief that they are more open to private accounts and overhauling the entire Social Security program. As Andrea Battista Schlesinger of the Drum Major Institute for Public Policy, a progressive think tank, stated, the left isn't even talking to young people, while the right just assumes it already has their support. Yet, a poll commissioned for Rock the Vote, AARP, and the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies found that 65% of young adults opposed private accounts once they were told it would mean lower retirement benefits. During the 2004 election, Rock the Vote and pop icons like P. Diddy and Russell Simmons turned out a wave of new young voters to the polls. Rock the Vote in particular was credited with making the subject of a revived military draft an issue in the presidential campaign. A key question is whether young people burdened by college loans and high credit card debt are ready to carry the added burden of management fees associated with the privatized social security system. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
Despite repeated denials from President Bush and others in his administration that the U.S. government does not engage in torture or hand over prisoners to nations that do, a number of eyewitness accounts and press reports contradict those White House assertions. After the September 11th attacks on New York City and Washington, the Bush administration adopted a policy called Extraordinary Rendition that permitted the transfer of a small number of terrorist suspects to nations that employed brutal interrogation methods illegal in the U.S. In recent years, the government's rendition policy has greatly expanded, with estimates placing the number of U.S.-held prisoners transferred to nations employing torture at 150. Those who have been subject to the policy include Maher Arar, a Canadian citizen who was detained in New York City and then sent to Syria, where he suffered months of torture before being released without charge. Another prisoner, Mabdou Habib, accused of training several of the 9/11 hijackers, was held in the U.S.-run Guantanamo Bay Cuba detention facility and later transferred to Egypt, where he claims he was beaten and burned. A piece in the February 8th edition of the New Yorker magazine by Jane Mayer, titled Outsourcing Torture, details the rendition program and some of the allegations made against the Bush administration. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights and a principal attorney for prisoners being held at the Guantanamo U.S. Naval Base. Ratner expresses his grave concern about the rendition policy and the message sent to the world by the recent Senate confirmation of Alberto Gonzalez as the Bush administration's new attorney general.
Well, we became aware of this really in December 2002. There were some articles in the Washington Post that the U.S. had a practice called extraordinary rendition. Now, there's always been a small practice of rendition, even under Clinton, where they pick up people in one country and then deliver them to another country for purposes usually of criminal prosecution when they can't get cooperation, et cetera. That's not a legal practice, but they did that in a handful of cases. After 9/11, it became apparent from certain news articles and other sources that they had a new practice called extraordinary rendition. It meant two things. They were going to do this on a broad basis to pick up people all over the world, essentially disappear them from their homes, their communities, or their countries, or from whatever country they were in, and take them to places where they would be subjected to interrogation through torture. And the places they would take them to would be Egypt, Morocco, in the case of, we represent Maher Arar, a man taken to Syria, and some other countries. And they did that, I think, partly for two reasons. One is they claimed that there were techniques they didn't want to use on people, which were torture, and that somehow that would be legal if other countries did it, and they didn't. Of course, that's not a good legal excuse. That's aiding and abetting. And secondly, what's interesting, of course, is the U.S. wound up engaging in torture anyway. The first person we got that gave us a glimpse into it was a man named Maher Arar. He was coming back from Tunisia, a Canadian citizen, on a transit flight at Kennedy, picked up at Kennedy, claimed to be a terrorist by the government of the United States, sent to Syria in one of those private citation jets, which is what they do to deliver people all over the world, and tortured in Syria. Eventually, because he was Canadian, because we knew he was there, because he had been able to call his wife from Kennedy before he got taken out, we got him out after 10 months and 10 days in an underground prison cell. Since then, There's been more and more documents of this practice. And the practice is not only nasty in the sense that it, of course, violates borders and is kidnapping, but it's actually disappearing people and, in many cases, I think, disappearing them for torture and maybe never to be heard from again. For example, I don't think people expected Arar, the man in Syria, to ever be heard from again. So it's a major practice going on now. Our country has its hands really up to its elbows, if not higher, in this practice.
What is being done by human rights groups and your organization to challenge this practice?
Scott, it's been the hardest to get to. You know, we have lawsuits pending on Guantanamo, obviously, and torture. We have a Freedom of Information Act case that we've brought with a variety of other groups, Physicians for Human Rights, ACLU, and others, to try and get to the bottom. Groups like the investigations that were appointed by our government, like the Schlesinger investigation and others, if you read those reports that came out, CIA refuses to talk to anybody about what they were doing. If you look at the Gonzales memos and all those other torture memos, those in some way were really essentially to allow the CIA to engage in certain practices of torture. And the rendition memos, the ones about extraordinary rendition, that were asked for by the subcommittee in approving Gonzales, the Judiciary Committee, never saw the light of day, so we don't know what they say. This is a very, very hard area to get to. In some way, it's the Achilles heel. It's where the worst aspects of the utterly illegal so-called war on terror are occurring.
Alberto Gonzales was just confirmed as the new U.S. Attorney General. What message does this send to the world about America's tolerance towards torture and future policies that are liable to come out of the Bush administration regarding torture?
Well, it's incredibly distressing. I mean, Alberto Gonzales not only was the one who penned, authored, was responsible for the memo that called the interrogation practices or protections of the Geneva Conventions obsolete and other provisions quaint, and who's the one who said that Geneva should not apply to people picked up and the humane provisions of Geneva should not apply. He is the one who was also involved in the famous Bybee memo that said that defined torture so narrowly that everything you saw at Abu Ghraib would not be considered torture, and who still today insists that non-citizens, and I want to stress this, non-citizens held outside the United States are not protected from cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, which is our lawyer's word for essentially inhumane treatment, just a shade underneath underneath torture. So that's the man who has been confirmed. What message does it send? It sends two messages to me and I think to our allies and to all over the world and to the human rights community. One is that we're not only refusing to investigate and go up the chain of command in torture, but we are actually elevating the positions of the very torturers and those involved in torture themselves. So Alberto Gonzales was confirmed as Attorney General. Mr. Chertoff is up for head of Homeland Security. His nomination has been held up a little bit pending some of the memos, but he again was apparently involved in approving various techniques that I think constitute torture. You have Rumsfeld being extended for 4 more years as the Department of Defense head, Secretary of Defense. Again, he was deeply involved in the abuses. You have General Sanchez, and head of Iraq at the time of Abu Ghraib, head of the forces there, being considered for a 4th star. So we're elevating the people, and in my view, that makes all those people who are willing to elevate them, vote for them, think that they should get their jobs, essentially complicit, and if not the torture itself, in the cover-up of the torture. A number of human rights groups have called for either an independent investigation or now special prosecutors to be appointed on the grounds that Alberto Gonzales is basically completely disqualified.
That was Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Contact the center by calling area code 212-614-6464 or visit the center's website at www.ccr-ny.org. Michael Ratner is co-author, along with Ellen Ray, of the book Guantanamo, What the World Should Know. A recently signed peace treaty between the Sudanese government, based in the north, and rebels in the south, has hopefully ended one of Africa's longest-running wars. But the killing and displacement of Sudanese in the western province of Darfur continues. The conflict has resulted in an estimated 300,000 killed, with about 2 million displaced, including internal refugees and those who have fled to neighboring Chad. Washington has labeled attacks by the central government of Sudan on the people of Darfur as genocide, where a rebel group has been fighting government forces and Arab militias known as the Janjaweed. The African Union has 1,000 troops on the ground working as observers out of a force of 4,000 the coalition has pledged to deploy in order to stop the killing in Darfur. The Bush administration is now attempting to block a referral of war crimes committed in Darfur to the International Criminal Court, working instead to have the cases adjudicated by a tribunal run by the UN and African Union in Tanzania. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Chris Dussault of Hartford, Connecticut, who was part of a four-member Catholic worker peace team that spent 2 weeks in Darfur in December.
We went to see the conditions, investigate the genocide, hear from people on the ground, and also to see if there were folks in Darfur that were using Gandhian nonviolence as a way to disrupt or intervene in the genocide. First of all, we found people that are incredibly strong. We met people in the refugee camps, women and children who had lost their husbands and their fathers. They had been raped, their villages burned. They had walked for days across the desert, losing children to thirst along the way. And still these people had incredible spirits. What we found was that the people of Sudan, the people in Darfur in particular, are tired after decades of civil war. And when it looked like peace was about to be had with the South in the civil war, the government turned its attention to the West and to this genocide. Massive amounts of arms have been poured into the West to arm the so-called Janjaweed, who have forcibly displaced over a million African Darfurians from their farmland into neighboring Chad and refugee camps within Darfur itself. It's an awful situation. The point being, in terms of the war ending, the government is now able to redeploy arms and material to the West to increase the attacks on the people there. This is in part because oil has been discovered. Sudan right now is exporting oil at about $1 billion a year in income. Much of that income is being used to benefit the people in the northern part of the country and also to purchase armaments. To get access to that oil, a lot of people need to be displaced, and that's one of the reasons I believe that the genocide is happening.
Tell us if you noticed any difference that was made by the presence of troops from the African Union that were supposed to be doing some kind of peacekeeping in the region. Did you see anyone from that peacekeeping force?
They're not a peacekeeping force, they're an observation force. And we did see the African Union troops, and we talked with some of the African Union officers. They are there to observe only. When they go out on patrols or whatever, they do not go out armed. And their mandate specifically prohibits them from intervening. They're there as an observation force only. I believe there must be an intervention, but I believe that there can be and ought to be a nonviolent intervention.
By whom?
Well, that's the question. By whom? There really isn't at this point in our development as as humanity that we've been able to get our act together to have a nonviolent force. It's not as though nonviolence hasn't worked in the past, hasn't worked in the recent past. The rejection of the bogus elections in the Ukraine, that was an organized, disciplined, nonviolent movement. The movement to remove Milosevic from power, that was an organized, nonviolent movement. And there are people that are training folks in this nonviolence. There's a fellow up at Harvard University, Gene Sharp. He's a political scientist. And he's written extensively on the methods, the politics, and the theory of nonviolence, not as a pacifist or anything, but as a political scientist. His writings were, in fact, taken by the United States USAID, translated into Serbo-Croat, condensed into pamphlet form, and distributed all over Yugoslavia. And the people there used this information to organize themselves to nonviolently remove Milosevic from power. This weapon, if you want to use that word, could be a very successful method of intervention if we were willing to invest in it, invest our time, our lives.
So just getting back to the first thing you raised, when you said you wanted to see if Gandhian principles were being used, it sounds like they're not right now, but you have hope that they might be?
Well, we did meet one group called Aya in the town of Niala. And they, when we met them, they had the fellow organizing Aya had in his office a dozen men that were either sheikhs or chiefs from various tribes that were committed to trying to resolve conflicts before they escalated. And while we were talking with them, he brought up Gandhi, not us. They said that they would be very much interested in being a resource if nonviolent persons were to want to go to Darfur and try to organize some sort of potential nonviolent force.
That was Chris Dussault, a member of the Catholic Worker Peace Team that visited Darfur in December. Contact the group by calling area code 860-724-7066 or visit their website at www.hartfordcatholicworker.org. Since the November presidential election, the Bush administration's strategy for handling media relations has come into focus through multiple scandals involving government payments to journalists, most notably columnist Armstrong Williams, in exchange for favorable coverage of GOP policies. Williams, a columnist and broadcast talk show host, was paid $240,000 to promote the president's No Child Left Behind Act. Two other print journalists, Maggie Gallagher and Michael McManus, were paid lesser sums to support a White House marriage initiative. The newest set of revelations involved Jeff Gannon, also known as James Guckert, who was given credentials to attend daily White House press briefings and at least one rare presidential press conference. It turns out that Gannon, who regularly asked questions denigrating Democrats and praising Republicans, was not a journalist at all, but rather a GOP activist. Investigations into Gannon disclosed that he worked under a fake name for the fringe conservative outlet Talon News, with direct connections to the right-wing organization GOP USA. After the scandal erupted, Gannon resigned from Talon News, but the controversy about the way in which the Bush administration handles its relationship with the press has only intensified. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Steve Rendell, senior analyst with the Media Watch Group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, who examines what some are now describing as a White House taxpayer-funded propaganda machine.
Well, of course, the Jeff Gannon or James Guckert story, that's his real name, is part of a bigger story about a White House propaganda campaign. You not only have Armstrong Williams, the columnist and radio talk show host, there's Maggie Gallagher, the columnist, and Michael McManus, the columnist. All three were receiving White House money. They were not telling their viewers or listeners or readers. They were basically perpetrating a lie. They were presenting themselves to the public, to the reader, to the viewer, to the listener, as independent commentators when they were really acting as covert agents for the White House. They were government propagandists masquerading as independent commentators. The Jeff Gannon story, which is the latest, is a little bit different. Here we're talking about somebody who was working for a publication called Talon News, which by all indications was the sister publication of something called GOP USA. The two publications were published by the same person out of the same location, and apparently it was staffed by Republican activists. I mean, the real story is how he got White House press credentials. How can a reporter who, by the way, was using a fake name, he was going by Jeff Gannon, his real name is James Guckert, working for a Republican Party partisan news organizations, get press credentials from the White House? And how can he then parlay that into actually being able to ask questions on a fairly regular basis of Scott McClellan, the White House press secretary, and on at least one and reportedly two occasions, he was actually privileged to question the President of the United States. It's an interesting story.
Steve Rendell, is the U.S. press corps complicit in any of this in that they looked upon a man with little or no credentials as a journalist, asking outrageous questions in press conferences, but yet many of these mainstream journalists chose not to rock the boat or ask too many questions, maybe concerned that they would lose access themselves if they made things tough for the White House?
Well, you know, I think that's a great question. Dave Lindorf, in the latest Counterpunch, asks a very similar question. He says, why was it so easy for a Republican shill posing under a false name as a journalist to last as long as he did, hiding out there among members of the legitimate White House press corps? And why did it take bloggers, by the way, to expose him? And Lindorf answers this question by saying, quote, "The answer is Gannon's puffball questioning of the president was not that different from the questions that are routinely asked by the mainstream reporters in that gaggle of fine suits and well-coiffed hair." And I think Dave Lindorf, in this piece on Counterpunch, is perhaps exaggerating the point a little bit. I mean, Jeff Gannon's question really was a puffball. It was almost as if he was asking George Bush if he liked ice cream. It was a big setup, a very partisan question. But I think Dave Lindorf is making a point here, and that is that you have this culture, this atmosphere of servility among the press corps. Journalists have to, after all, maintain access. And with this White House, more than any others, but previous ones were punitive too, this White House is a very punitive White House. Tough questions. Anything that crosses this White House is likely to be punished. So what you have is a press corps that basically sits around asking puffball questions, with a few exceptions.
Some Democrats are asking for an investigation, or are calling for an investigation here, about public funds being spent on this virtual propaganda campaign on behalf of the White House. But on another level, I wonder where the outrage is about the blatant violation of ethics, public trust, and again, the misuse of public funds. It seems like a frog slowly being boiled in water, and we're all not realizing the real critical nature of all these abuses.
Yeah, we've almost become numb. I think it's hard, especially for the mainstream media, to maintain any sort of sense of outrage about this, in part because part of their job is not to draw too much negative attention to the White House. And I think they don't want to say, wow, this White House really deals with the media in a corrupt, underhanded, and double-dealing fashion. Because you can't say that, because it's just, you know, it's, as we've published many times at FAIR and on our show Counterspin, is that you're not allowed to say that the White House is lying, or to call the president a liar. That's even worse. To expect reporters who will not go after the White House or the government on just epical issues like the Iraq War and the Middle East conflict to defend their own rights and to defend their own access and their own right to ask tough questions, I think it's maybe asking too much.
That was Steve Rendell, senior analyst with Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Call FAIR at area code 212-633-6700 or visit their website at www.fair.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Indu Anand, Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minus, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.